papermen meet such interesting people. They know the lowdown, now it can be told. I'll tell you quite reliably off the record about some charming people I have known. For I meet politicians and grafters by the score, killers plain and fancy, it's really quite a bore. Oh, newspapermen meet such interesting people. They wallow in corruption, crime and gore. Ting-a-ling-ling, city desk, pull the press, extra, extra, read all about it, it's a mess, meets the test. Oh, newspapermen meet such interesting people. It's wonderful to represent the press. Now you remember Mrs. Sadie Smucker.
The Media Project is a half hour of commentary and analysis where we look at the current operation of the media through the lens of the experience of some folks who are veteran journalists in New York's capital region. I'm Rex Smith, your host here, a formerly editor of the Times Union, now doing the Upstate American on Substack. I am here with my colleagues, Barbara Lombardo and Judy Patrick. Barbara Lombardo being formerly executive editor of the Saratogian and the Record of Troy, and Judy Patrick, formerly editor of the Daily Gazette of Schenectady. How y'all?
Doing well.
You can't cut your tongue there, Judy.
Well, Judy, you know.
Judy, wake up.
You know, it's been a horrific year of news and a horrific week or so. So on this week's show, can we at least spend a little bit of time on something frivolous? And that would be the coverage of Santa Claus.
You think that's frivolous?
Uh-oh, we're right into the midst of controversy right now. Absolutely, we should do Santa Claus. And you're up to that, Barbara? Santa Claus also?
I think that should be included in today's discussion.
And?
Absolutely.
We shall. We shall. You know, here's the thing. I have some sympathy for the folks who run television networks and make the decisions of our national agenda-setting media. When you look at the speech to the nation by Donald Trump, in which the White House presented this request, the president's going to make a speech to the nation. We want you to preempt your programming and air it. Now, just to be clear, networks don't have to do this. And there is precedent for networks declining. About three quarters of the way through Barack Obama's term, he wanted to do an address on immigration. He was facing a lot of criticism because people said, oh, you're the deporter in chief. He deported more people from America than any president until this year, Donald Trump. But the networks refused to air it. They refused to carry the speech live. Notwithstanding all the concerns about what Donald Trump might be up to, the networks all carried the speech. Only Fox News went along with the White House request that they use some PowerPoints, basically some slides with data to support what he said. Fox did that and put the president in the lower right-hand corner of the screen. The others did not. And I have to say, listening to the speech, watching the speech, you heard the usual, frankly, blather from Donald Trump, the immense amount of untruth that he spouts quickly, the silliness, I've cut drug prices by 400, 500, 800%, which is, of course, mathematically impossible. I mean, somehow, let's brag about the fact that he has a degree from Penn. Anyway, somehow it is a dilemma that I think the folks who run networks face, because if you say no to this president, you know that there will be a price to pay. But if you say yes, you're giving in to what you know is going to be a departure from the journalistic requirement to try to tell the truth. So what do you do?
I was at first resistant to the idea of him giving this speech on a primetime television. And I thought, well, you know, it's the end of the year. Maybe it's his first year. Maybe he is going to sum up, you know, the year and outline his plans for the future. And that's exactly what the press secretary said was going to happen. That's not what happened. But then I also thought, well, maybe he's going to lay out his cogent plan for what he's doing in the Caribbean, blowing up all those boats. Maybe, you know, his foreign policy. Maybe this is what is going to happen.
What's in your eggnog?
I know. You know, I keep thinking he's going to change, but he's always the same.
But what do you do if you have to make a decision and you know that the FCC, as the chair of the FCC said to Congress that very day that the president spoke, we're not an independent agency. You know that they could come down hard on you.
That's true, but I also think as a TV outlet, I think the owners of the stations have a responsibility also to say, okay, it's the president of the United States. It's going to be a 15-minute speech, may turn out to be 18, 19 minutes. that if they don't do that, then it looks like they are censoring the president of the country from speaking. So I think the middle ground is that you say, yes, we're going to give the 15 minutes or 20 minutes, as it turns out, but be prepared at the same time to then report on it immediately after the speech in real time. There's nothing new that was said that they shouldn't have been able to analyze. Certainly, Fox had Newt Gingrich on to reinforce the lies that were told.
And, great.
And call it a 19-minute disciplined speech.
Disciplined.
Meaning that he read the teleprompter. He was like an angry hostage because it wasn't a typical... Content might have been kind of typical, but it wasn't delivered in a typical fashion. It wasn't as rambling.
But what if he asked for 15 minutes every night or once a week or once a month? What are the stations supposed to do? Because, I mean, it's a slippery slope. Once a year seems reasonable. We're going to have the State of the Union address come January. I mean, I guess FDR, did he give his fireside chats once a week or once a...
No, but they were pretty frequent.
And it was during a war, though.
Yeah, and it was a new medium, you know, radio, the notion of a president taking to the radio airwaves to reach the country. It was such a wonderful notion to people to actually hear the president himself. So I think that was great. And typically, I think that it is... useful when a president decides to speak to the nation. There is typically value in this, but nothing is typical about this president. And we've learned by this point that those of us in the fact-based media understand that he has no commitment to the truth. And so I guess you're right. We have just the opportunity to fact check afterwards.
And then to do what you said, Judy, is measure how often are we going to allow this to happen? And to say, okay, this was holiday time. We gave the president his 15 minutes of holiday time. But if there's additional efforts to do it, then you have to have the courage to say no.
Right. And also in this digital age, you almost think that there would be a way for them to do real-time fact-check, like have a scroll down the side of people fact-checking him. And that I don't see that happening.
Oh, the New York Times does. Actually, you have reporters.
Print media does,
yes, but TV does not. Yep, legacy. The New York Times, actually, reporters are right on top of it. And it takes a couple of minutes to actually keep in some of the stuff. But that's how I was watching, actually, with my handheld device right there to see what they're saying.
Right, but for actually having it on television for them to be able to have it and type it in, because he's moved on to another point as he's talking. I looked at headlines that different news outlets were using, and Reuters had in holiday speech, Trump highlights victory amid sinking poll numbers. NBC News, Trump seeks to defend his economy in primetime speech. NPR used the same verb, Trump defends his record as voters grow anxious over costs.
AP calls it partisan and defiant. The Times said it was bellicose. Depend upon the Times to choose a word that most Americans don't know. But it was accurate. Bellicose indeed.
Yeah, the AP, I looked to see what the Times Union ran, and they had the AP story, which focused on Trump speaking loud and fast and angrily.
Right. These are style stories more than substance stories, primarily because the substance was so off, I think, that they could have spent a lot more time talking about the lack of real data or real information. But what they had to go on was the style, which was apparently very fast.
But this is how journalism has been forced to change by this revolutionary figure in American politics. You can't imagine a headline in any prior presidency like this. The subhead on this New York Times story, the president cited misleading statistics to insist, wrongly, that prices were coming down. And to actually state that in a headline about a president of the United States has never been necessary before. And that's why the world is so different, even as we are confronted by technological change and societal change that is changing journalism. We've got a political change that is putting journalism in a very awkward situation because we have a leader who has no commitment to truth-telling, and truth-telling is the fundamental of journalism.
I applaud the New York Times for that subhead because it explains things plainly, clearly, accurately, fairly. And even though it was wordy, but that's almost a sentence nowadays for those kind of a subheads to summarize. And if they hadn't done that, they would have abdicated the responsibility to point out that what you're listening to is not true. you know, unfortunately, a lot of people that need to hear that aren't going to see it.
So there is a continuing division. One of our listeners, Winthrop and Port Jervis, wrote to say, press can't engage with him. It simply feeds his mouth, his views, his voice. I guess that's in the context of, should reporters be challenging him on the spot when he denigrates reporters, as he typically does, especially female reporters? Should other reporters then step in, as some journalists are urging, step in and ask the question again on behalf of the person whom the president just denigrated? What do you think about that?
I agree with that. I think that the press corps, and I think we've talked about this in recent weeks, that the press corps has to represent the public, and to do that, they have to stick together and not get rolled over. It's ridiculous to think that there's transparency in this administration because Trump talks a lot of the time to reporters. He talks at them. He lies at them. He cuts them off. So there's not really the transparency about what's going on in the administration that you might think. Just because there's a lot of press conferences, there's not real opportunities to talk to him.
And what are journalists to do about the fact when what is supposedly the ultimate source, the federal government, is simply wrong? Consider the coverage of the Bondi Beach and Brown University attacks, where the media was confronted on this very singular weekend with terrible violence and the murder of Rob Reiner and his wife, where the output from the federal government, from the FBI director in the White House, turned out to be wrong. This makes you dubious, frankly, of anything that comes out, right? How do you deal with that?
Oh, and it totally undermines their credibility. I mean, we used to, in the Brown University case, for example, the FBI was putting out information early on that a suspect was in custody. This is long before the person of interest was being interviewed. But this was wrong. The president put it out and did not walk it back. And when people on social media saw that, especially vulnerable students at Brown University, that may have given them a measure of confidence that they could go out of the room, that they didn't need to shelter in place. This was in the immediate aftermath. I mean, how this has been handled after this has been a disaster as well. But by the federal government issuing bad information, it has serious public consequences.
There is precedent for erroneous information going out, of course. For example, when President Reagan was shot and his press secretary, Jim Brady, also was felled by a bullet. Initially, CBS News reported that Brady had died. Within a few minutes, they walked it back and said our previous reporting was inaccurate. But usually when you cite a source, which is one of the reasons, frankly, journalists cite sources, not just say this has happened, but usually when you cite a key federal source, you know that that's true. But when Kash Patel, the embattled FBI director, let's say, a few hours after Charlie Kirk was assassinated, he posted on X that the suspect was in custody, and then he had to say, well, he's been released and he was not arrested, in fact, until 24 hours later. A suspect was not arrested until then. Kash Patel was wrong. Same sort of thing. The president's assertions about the director, Rob Reiner, and his wife, Michelle, being killed. The president on Truth Social rants that it was due to the anger that he caused others through Trump derangement syndrome. Ay, ay, ay. So we actually have what ought to be the most authoritative source in government no longer actually a trustworthy source. I just think it's interesting to consider that, and to consider that in the context of a decision to carry the president's speech. You have to always be prepared these days to assert contrary to what the official record would otherwise be. It's a burden on journalism that didn't used to exist.
It is. And in the case of the Rob Reiner, for example, Brett Stevens, who is a conservative-leaning guy, had an excellent column in the New York Times about the Americans trying to hold on to a sense of decency in the face of a president and he's using the remarks that he tweeted and then doubled down on about Rob Reiner. And there was an opportunity for a leader to point out a horrible tragedy and to wish the family condolences. And it doesn't matter what one's politics are. In fact, James Woods, who is a right-wing actor, had very nice remarks about the Reiners that was reported, and he said, do I agree with some of his ideas about patriotism? No. He was a great patriot. He doesn't agree with me. I don't agree with him, but he respected my patriotism. They respected one another, and so he was able to express that, and things like that did get some coverage.
You know, while the federal government's credibility is really under question at this point, I would like to applaud at least the state and local police agencies or law enforcement agencies, because especially in the Providence case, I think that they are being very careful. They are trying to be as upfront as they can about releasing video. The police chief there is advising people just to rely on information released by them and to not manipulate images with AI. I mean, I think he is out front there trying to make sure that the flow of information is credible and that we can trust him when he says something.
Credit also, by the way, to the Brown University student journalists who were on top of this story and reported effectively. Credit to those journalists who managed to come through with a report. And the Washington Post was first to find the young woman who had survived a school shooting in high school and then went through it again as a Brown University student. So there has been some really wonderful reporting going on that is the sort that brings a human dimension to this kind of a story. It's not just a tragedy to look at from afar. One of the key roles of journalism, I think, is to encourage empathy, which is a fundamental human skill, I'd say. And by bringing forth the stories of people who are in the midst of these crises and humanizing, putting a face on all of these situations, journalism is doing a service and not just looking at events from afar and coldly. So that's good journalism.
Yeah, from a local angle, I'd like to see some, I don't know when was the last time any of this was done, but some localization of how safe are our campuses. And certainly we all understand that anything can happen at any campus at any time. But what is being done at our campuses, and this is a really college-rich region as far as cameras, locked doors, security personnel. Question is, what does it mean to me? What will it mean to my child going to school?
By the way, on to another topic. As an editor, here you are offering an idea for a story that you might suggest a reporter would undertake. And we've had these conversations as former editors, all of us. But sometimes an editor's interest can lead to a good story. Sometimes our suggestions are not welcomed.
Can you believe that?
I can't believe that. She said sarcastically. No, but nobody really appreciates it when an editor comes in commuting in the springtime when the potholes are there and says, that's the worst potholes we've ever had. Get some reporters on this. But it is interesting. I think people ordinarily don't understand how stories bubble up from reporters' notebooks, from their beat. And people who are editors usually don't have to step in, am I right, and say, let's do this story. Usually your reporters know what they need to be reporting.
It depends.
Right. I think that reporters with a good beat can generate a lot of stories, and especially if they're good reporters. But I've seen reporters struggle to come up with ideas. And in fact, we got to the point where generating story ideas was a skill we were trying to develop with especially younger reporters or reporters with less experience, trying to explain to them where to find the stories, not to just go to the town clerk and ask what's new, although that's always good to do. Generating story ideas is something that they needed some help with. But the editor driving in and finding the pothole or seeing a police car pull somebody over and wanting the cops reporter to find out what's happening, the cops reporter would always roll their eyes, because they've been listening to that scanner all day. And I would say that the times when that actually generated a story are probably zero.
Well, I think there are some people whose natural journalism instincts, their curiosity, that you can see, and I think the three of us here feel this way about ourselves, that you see a story in everything, or a potential story in just about everything. And so there are up-and-coming journalists who feel that way, and other ones, I think, comes with maturity and experience to recognize what makes a story and asking, what does it mean to me? What will it mean to my readers? And yeah, it exists, but it's
an interesting skill. You're right. And I think that's a great idea to have an initiative in a newsroom kind of develop story-finding skills. What a notion. Because it isn't necessarily a natural thing. And some people become journalists because they like to question people, because they're naturally dubious of what they see in the world around them. And those are often your best reporters, sometimes your hardest people to manage as well. But that is an interesting concept of who chooses journalism. It might be the folks who raise questions about everything they see, who find that kind of place.
And what you said also reminded me of many years ago in the newsroom, there was a visit from corporate people and they were, you know, lecturing us about, I think might have been the same time that they're making some cuts in staff, and they're lecturing us about, well, there's a lot of AP stories and these should be localized. And one of my editors in the newsroom mutters to me, localize the story. Why didn't we ever think of that?
Yes, it's such a typical way to do something, but it is good. That was actually a very good idea. Why aren't there stories about the security of campuses in the capital region? Maybe there are.
Sadly, you can write that just about any time.
Yeah, you can.
Right. And sadly, I'm sure that the local newspaper editors saying, yeah, well, who's going to do that? I continue to send story ideas to local editors. And oftentimes, you know, they go, great idea, but who am I going to get to do it? Because they don't have the manpower anymore to attack those kinds of stories.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. All right. We promised that we were going to talk about covering Santa Claus. How do you do that? I mean, talk about a mythical character.
You have to be nice.
Not no crying.
But it can be a real issue. I mean, the classic story is going out and interviewing the mall Santa. And I'm even afraid to even say this. But do you identify the person who is behind?
What do you mean?
Oh, geez. I mean, so and so how do you handle that? Because you've got to consider the audience. Is some little kid going to pick up the newspaper and say, see here, the newspaper says this is a guy at the mall?
In your dreams, somebody under 60 picks up a newspaper.
Well, so wasn't there a letter to Santa Claus or a letter written in a Troy newspaper where they said?
Well, yes, Virginia,
there is a Santa Claus.
Actually, it's Francis Farcellus Church who wrote the editorial in the New York Sun. What it actually was is this. The first publication of the famous Christmas poem, "'Twas the Night Before Christmas," was in the Troy Sentinel newspaper on December 23rd, 1823. So that was supposedly written by Clement Clark Moore. And that poem introduced key elements of the Santa myth, you know, a jolly elf, reindeer-powered sleigh, ho, 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 and gift-giving. So with Troy being the birthplace of that iconic poem, that's why the Troy Record publishes it every year.
My feeling is that people in journalism need to have some fun.
Yeah.
Need to let people enjoy life. This is not like saying that it was okay to do a double strike or even a single strike on a Venezuelan boat. This is just, how do I say this without, people could be listening to this show as we're talking about it. So I think that we should just go with the flow that Santa exists and not worry about if you're doing a mall Santa story that you really want to honor the person who's doing it for some reason. They've been doing it for so many years. I think that you could say he's Santa's helper.
There you go.
There's my solution for that end of it.
I have a general distaste of anniversary journalism. This is so annoying. I could count on it. Every Pearl Harbor Day, I would get phone calls from readers unhappy that on December the 7th, we hadn't published a remembrance of Pearl Harbor. And my point was, well, we're a daily newspaper. We will publish the remembrance ceremonies today in tomorrow's paper. But, you know, still, it is just annoying. The job is to report the news, not to report the news of 50 years ago. But people want to see some of this. They want to have a salute.
There is still news. The fact that Pearl Harbor might have happened, whatever the event is, 50 years ago, the news is that people still remember and should remember that whatever it is happening.
No, so, I tell you, my mother called me every year to make sure the newspaper had something about Pearl Harbor.
And I would get that same person probably called me about Pearl Harbor.
She was probably my mother called both of us.
I could have been it. And I actually felt bad about it because what we could have and should have done was on Pearl Harbor Day, so the night before, having for the paper to acknowledge today is whatever and there's going to be some ceremony somewhere or whatever
is
expected.
Yeah, we would do
something
that,
to be on the record.
I know.
It wasn't enough.
Being it on the record is not enough. And I don't know where you draw the line. Why is Pearl Harbor the thing that you do and not 9/11? Or what about the Civil War? What about the terrible battles of World War I? Why are we only paying attention to that? So I just think that the focus of journalism is not about, it can't be about writing about history. It really has to be.
So 9/11, is that far enough for you now?
I don't know. I mean, I think you write about what's going on, but I don't think you write a remembrance every day on 9/11.
You know, I almost think anniversary journalism is shortcut journalism. It's lazy journalism. If there's nothing else to write about, let's do that. Pearl Harbor, 9/11 may be exceptions, but a lot of these five-year anniversaries, 10-year anniversary, it's just laziness.
All of that said, folks, we're coming up to Christmas, and it is a great tradition that there's always something on the front page for people who observe Christmas, and it is now as much a secular holiday as a religious one, so I think it's okay to wish everybody a Merry Christmas. How about that?
As the Jewish person on the panel, I'll accept it as a season greeting type of greeting. It's meant in good cheer, with warmth and generosity.
Absolutely.
So, and Merry Christmas to you guys.
Very well. And you also have a great one, folks. That's the Media Project. Barbara Lombardo, Judy Patrick, and I'm Rex Smith. We're grateful to our producer, Dave Gustina, for making this possible. Thanks for joining us. We hope to see you next week on the Media Project.
Our newspapermen are such interesting people. When they know they've got a people's fight to wage. Ting-a-ling-a-ling, newspaper guild. Got a free new world to build. Meet the people, that's a thrill. All together fits the bill. Oh, newspapermen are such interesting people. It's wonderful to represent the guild. Now, you remember Mrs. Sadie Smuggery. She wanted money to buy a new fur coat. To get insurance, she employed skullduggery. She up and cut her husband's only throat. She chopped him into fragments, she stuffed him in a trunk. She shipped it all back yonder to her uncle in Podunk. Now newspapermen meet such interesting people. It must have startled poor old Sadie's unk. Ting-a-ling-a-ling, city desk. Hold the press, extra, extra, read all about it.
The Media Project is a national production of WAMC, Northeast Public Radio. This week's projectors include former Times Union editor and current Upstate American Substack columnist Rex Smith, Judy Patrick, former vice president for editorial development for the New York Press Association and former editor of the Daily Gazette, and Barbara Lombardo, adjunct professor at University at Albany and former editor of the Saratogian. You can listen to The Media Project anytime at WAMCpodcast.org or anywhere you get your podcasts. I'm your producer, David Gustina. Thanks for listening.
On a living stage now, newspapermen are such interesting people. When they know they've got a people's fight to wage. Ting-a-ling-a-ling, newspaper guild. Got a free new world to build. Meet the people, that's a thrill. All together fits the bill. Oh, newspapermen are such interesting people. It's wonderful to represent the guild. Now, publishers are such interesting people. Their policy is an acrobatic thing. They claim to represent the common people. It's funny, Wall Street never has complained. Ah, but publishers have worries, for publishers must go to working folks for readers and to big shots for their dough. Now publishers are such interesting people. It could be prostitution, I don't know. Ting-a-ling-a-ling, circulation, ting-a-ling-a-ling, advertising, get those readers, get that payoff. What a headache, what a mess. Oh, publishers are such interesting people. Let's give three cheers for freedom of the press.